Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is a panel celebrating the release of two books. One is entitled People's China at 75, The Flag Stays Red, edited by Keith Bennett and panelist Carlos Martinez. The other book is the English translation of Western Marxism, How It Was Born, How It Died, How It Can Be Reborn, authored by Domenico Losurdo and edited by panelist Gabriel Rockhill. The third panelist is Danny Haifong, and the moderator is Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center. The talk took place at the office of the International Action Center in New York City on October 24, 2024, and was organized by Friends of Socialist China and Workers' World Party. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect my own views or those of this radio station.
Friends and allies and comrades, welcome. I want to just open this meeting before saying anything else or introducing our panel with a salute to the heroic revolutionary leader, Yahya Sinwar, chair of the Political Bureau of the Hamas Islamic Resistance Movement and organizer of the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood, who died heroically in battle along with other Hamas combatants on October 17th of this year, a martyr in battle against Zionism and U.S. imperialism. And his life is really an example. Resistance does not die with the martyrdom of leaders. Resistance lives on. It's driven by hunger of millions for liberation and for justice. And imperialism doesn't end with this or that politician at the helm. Its crimes continue relentlessly. So this is a book signing, and just before I even say more, I do want to mention a book that's not on the agenda, but worthy of its own event soon. And that is that Yahya Sinwar wrote a fascinating book called The Thorn and the Carnation during his long years in prison. It's painful, every page is a history lesson, but it's so simply told, you think it's a child speaking. It seems to have no analysis when you read the first and many chapters. But the first, really consciousness, how it unfolds, what side are you on? And you know that in every page, a worldview, and it's someone who knows what side they're on. So in welcoming you to this meeting, this is really organizers of the Friends of Socialist China. I'm Sarah Flounders. I'm an active part of Socialist China. And as an organization that has existed really for several years, I'm also part of the International Action Center, the Sanctions Kill Campaign, and a contributing editor to Workers' World newspaper. This is a meeting in the space of the International Action Center and Workers' World Party, but also many organizing efforts meet here, from Amazon workers, laundry workers, student encampments for Palestine, the Venceremos Brigade for Cuba. Tonight is a meeting of Marxists who are never dry in theory, because this is a science always being reborn in struggle, endlessly, forever green. Marx wrote in the Communist Manifesto, it's a history of all existing society as a history of the class struggle. And it's sure impossible to understand the world today without a Marxist lens. Marxism as a scientific outlook for action, to rally the oppressed, to take sides. And that means learning from and defending the political parties who are guiding revolutions that are transforming the lives of millions, coming to their defense. In the class struggle, it means constantly taking sides, consciously. There's no comfortable middle ground. There's a struggle against imperialism, and at its root, that is the class struggle today. To understand today's world, you need a Marxism that centers anti-colonial and anti-imperialist resistance. Now, we have an incredible panel tonight who really take a long view of history. They're writers who take sides in a global struggle, two sides, constantly in living struggle, the oppressed, the exploited, the working class globally. And it's that global view that's so essential. It is a global war, for sure, in a time of total epic change with an empire in crisis. As we meet, the BRICS Plus is meeting in Kazan. And you know, for the people of the world, this is more important, more decisive, actually of greater interest than the U.S. elections that the U.S. corporate media imposes on the world, even those who have no say. Well, this vampire ball is coming to an end. Saudi Arabia just proposed joint military exercises with Iran at a time, when Iran has openly pledged to target U.S. military bases in the region, including U.S. military bases in Saudi Arabia, should the U.S. dare to facilitate an Israeli attack on Iran. Now, that's a surprise. It certainly shows that the world right now is full of real, complex contradictions, and none of it is in the hands of the decision makers here. They're driven to war, even when you would think it's absolutely going against their interests. So there's an architecture of a different type that's developing, and Israel today is a totally dependent proxy of the U.S. It's a colonial outpost in a dying empire, and it is committing crimes that you cannot turn on your phone one day without being horrified at what's happening right now, every minute, the level of ruin and destruction. And this is the plans they're messaging the world we want for anyone who dares to resist. So it's constant crisis under imperialism. Now, the point of theory is to change the world, and understanding the world, understanding the way it really is the best way to build real class consciousness. I was fascinated with the title of Gabriel, Western Marxism. Well, Western, Eastern, it's not a geographic term that is being discussed. It really is how we move forward and understand the world today and how we really speak to each other in a world that is changing dramatically and radically. So I want to first introduce, and this is a big honor, that Carlos Martinez is here with us today. Now, I can't say Carlos Martinez and Keith Bennett have really helped to shape over years the Friends of Socialist China. And as such, what he's done in his research and his writings, I think we first were very interested in his book, The End of the Beginning, Lessons of the Soviet Collapse. That was published in 2019. And then his most recent book, which is really a tome of research, is The East is Still Red, Chinese Socialism in the 21st Century. And this new book is an anthology of so many of the participants of the China at 75, People's China at 75. And I just want to highly recommend the work of what Carlos has done. And I think it really reflects so much the panel that's here today.
Okay, thank you very much, Sarah, for that very kind introduction. And thank you to all the friends and comrades who are here in attendance, who are watching online. And of course, to the organizers for, you know, very kindly and at short notice putting on an event for these two books, People's China at 75, The Flag Stays Red, edited by myself and Keith Bennett, and Domenico Losurdo's Western Marxism, edited by Gabriel. So just to say a little something about the motivation for putting this book together. Obviously, we had this milestone, the 1st of October this year, marked the 75th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. And we thought it was appropriate and useful to just kind of reflect on that moment, you know, when Mao Zedong famously proclaimed in Tiananmen Square that the Chinese people have stood up. It's a useful opportunity to reflect on the significance of that, which is not just a moment in history, but it's an evolving significance because the Chinese Revolution impacted not just China, but it impacted the entire world, and it continues to impact the entire world. The Chinese Revolution changed the world forever, and you know, these processes that it reflects of building socialism and struggling against imperialism are processes that continue, and modern China is very much a part of that. And you know, so we wanted to examine China's trajectory since 1949 and help people get to grips with China's socialist development in all of its phases. And you know, this is a topic that's really not very well understood, particularly in the West and including among elements of the Western left. And I think, you know, maybe that's where the overlap lies with the two books that we're discussing this evening. You know, the Western Marxism that's described by Domenico Losurdo is essentially dogmatic. It considers socialism in the abstract. It considers it from a kind of purely theoretical viewpoint. And, you know, for these Western Marxists, if you ask them who's really pushing humanity's collective understanding of socialism forward, it's, you know, a bunch of Western male, typically white academics in conference rooms, you know, putting out vast, you know, enormous tomes of thousands of pages that are really at the cutting edge of knowledge production, right? But for Eastern Marxists, you know, to use Losurdo's terminology, and as Sarah mentioned, that's not a really a geographic framing. It's a conceptual and ideological framing. These people are oriented to the actually existing struggle against imperialism and for socialism. And it's precisely those states, those movements, those parties that are engaged in the process of building socialism and struggling against hegemony that are making that real contribution to moving humanity's understanding forward. This dialectical relationship between theory and practice is really the core essence of Marxism. You know, as Mao Zedong famously put it in his essay On Practice, if you want knowledge, you must take part in the practice of changing reality. If you want to know the taste of a pear, you must change the pear by eating it yourself. And abstract theory just doesn't help us very much when it comes to understanding modern China, right? Like, if you look in Marx's three volumes of Capital or three volumes of Theories of Surplus Value, you're not going to find a reference point for China's process of reform and opening up that kicks off in 1978, right? Apart from anything else, Marx and Engels didn't have the luxury of observing the development of state socialism, like with the exception of a few weeks of the Paris Commune. You know, they couldn't be expected to predict the sort of problems that might face a country like China in 2024 with its 1.4 billion people, 18% of the global population, with only 6% of the world's arable land. It has to feed that population. It has to respond to a situation where it's, you know, where the imperialist powers led by the United States are leading a campaign of encirclement and containment of China. It has to deal with nuclear blackmail and constant bullying. It has 14 land borders, and it has to break out of underdevelopment. It has to feed its people. It has to chart, you know, it's got a massive responsibility of charting a way forward for humanity. So you can't find any formulas for that. You know, you can read all the Marx you want and you can read all the Engels you want, but you're not going to find a magic wand that tells you how to defeat underdevelopment, how to prevent the overthrow of your revolutionary process by the imperialists, and how to build socialism and how to build a better life for your people, right? Like, just as no battle plan survives contact with the enemy, no revolutionary process proceeds in a straight and predictable line. As Lenin put it when discussing the heroic 1916 Easter Rising in Ireland, whoever expects a pure social revolution will never live to see it. Such a person pays lip service to revolution without understanding what revolution is. People see huge inequality in China. People see that there's billionaires in China. People see that there's private capital in China. People see there's McDonald's and KFC and Starbucks in China. And they say, well, this isn't socialism. You know, we're here in the West. We're fighting for socialism. And the socialism that we envisage doesn't have billionaires and it doesn't have KFC. But, you know, if you want to talk about socialist things, what about the elimination of absolute poverty? What about the extraordinary improvements in people's living standards? What about ending homelessness? What about, you know, the fact that you've got this vast Asian country of 1.4 billion people where literally every single human being has housing, everyone has access to decent food, everyone has clothing, everyone has access to running water, everyone has access to modern energy, you know, electricity and gas piped into their homes, everyone has access to education, everyone has access to healthcare. Like, here we are in New York, the throbbing heart of modern capitalism, the home of the brave. How far would I have to walk from this office right now to find someone who doesn't have a roof over their heads and someone who doesn't have healthcare? Right? I suspect not terribly far. So why is it that China has been able to solve these problems? Why is it that China's so focused on improving people's living standards and meeting people's most fundamental human rights? Why is it China that's so far out ahead when it comes to renewable energy and electric vehicles and biodiversity protection and afforestation? Why is it China that made so much effort to prevent loss of life during the COVID-19 pandemic, whereas in the US, over a million people died? Clearly, the answer has got something to do with China's social, economic, political project of socialism. The fact that China remains on the socialist path, that it's got a mixed economy in which the commanding heights are publicly owned, it's run by a Marxist-Leninist political party, and where the capitalist class is denied the right to organize in its own political interests. So in terms of the line that Losurdo draws in this book in Western Marxism, I think it's reasonable to basically say, and forgive me if this is like an exaggeration or a simplification, but I think, you know, on one side of that line, you have people who only criticize China and condemn China, people who label it as capitalist or imperialist, people who push the slogan, neither Washington nor Beijing. And on the other side of the line, you've got people who stand in solidarity with China, who seek to learn from China, who showcase China as an example of what can be achieved under socialism, and who resolutely oppose the US's plans to contain and encircle China, who oppose the US-led new Cold War on China. And so, yeah, this book, People's China at 75, The Flag Stays Red, goes into some detail about the development of Chinese socialism over the decades. I think I've probably kind of spoken for long enough, so I won't go into like a blow-by-blow account of what's in the book, but it's got chapters on a number of topics: understanding socialism with Chinese characteristics, China's transition to socialism in the early phase from 1949 to 56, the significance of China's second centenary goal, which is building China into a modern socialist country that is prosperous, strong, democratic, culturally advanced, harmonious, and beautiful by the centenary of the PRC in 2049, a pretty inspiring vision. We've got chapters on China's socialist democracy that kind of takes apart and dismantles this idea that China's just some authoritarian, dictatorial hellscape. We've got a chapter on what common prosperity means. We've got an article on Mao Zedong's specific contributions to the theory of Marxism. We've got a chapter on building socialism and the ecological civilization, so around what China's doing on environmental issues. Patient Finance by Professor Radhika Desai, who's a good friend and will be well known to most people here. And the last chapter is by me on how China survived the end of history, so how China made it past that period, 1989 to 1991, where so many of the socialist countries, the Soviet Union and the people's democracies of Eastern and Central Europe collapsed. How come China didn't collapse? So it is, in my view, a very useful book, as is Western Marxism, edited by Gabriel. And yeah, with those words, again, thank you so much for organizing this event. Thank you so much for attending this event. And I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent.
So Gabriel Rockhill is our next speaker. Gabriel Rockhill is a philosopher of a different kind, not an academic, and an activist who has published 9 other books. He's a founding director of the Critical Theory Workshop and a professor of philosophy at Villanova University, but very helpful in understanding and really critiquing the kind of housebroken, tamed Marxists of this predatory capitalist system, those who strip Marxism of its revolutionary character, the academic Marxists who find ways to support their own imperialist government again and again against the rising anti-colonial and revolutionary struggles of the whole global South. And they will have every reason, because imperialism seeps into the very culture even of the working class here and of the movements here. That's where there's the most fertile ground. And it's constantly checking our ideas, but also learning consciously from Marxists of the anti-imperialist struggles, who are centered concretely on, as Carlos was just saying, mobilizing the millions to change their own history. And they're facing horrific problems because they're the formerly colonized and looted countries of the world. So it's a very different process, a very concrete one, and one where we have enormous lessons to learn.
It's a real pleasure to be here. It is an honor to share the platform here with Danny, Sarah, and Carlos. I think it's a great project as well to bring these two books together, because in many ways they're talking about a similar theme, but from two different perspectives. Domenico Lussordo was an Italian Marxist who died a few years ago, but was a big supporter of China throughout his life, and I think wrote one of the most important accounts of why the reform and opening up in China is significant, because socialism is a collective, practical, concrete practice of learning, and the Chinese were studying what was being done elsewhere in the world, particularly in the Soviet Union, and they recognized that they had to take a unique path towards socialism. And Lussordo identified that very early on. So I'd also recommend Class Struggle is a book of his that's available in English, spells this out in quite some detail. I'd also like to thank Workers World for hosting us here and all of the organizers and the other political parties and organizations that have been involved in making this happen. My comments today are also drawing on, I co-authored the introduction to this book with Jennifer Ponce de Leon, who unfortunately couldn't be here. So I am carrying forth the spirit of her thoughts about this project as well in my prepared comments. I'm going to focus on Western Marxism, but I also just completed a book entitled Who Paid the Pipers of Western Marxism for Monthly Review Press. As you can tell from the title, it goes into the political economy of knowledge production, circulation, and consumption, and examines the ways in which the Western Marxists did not simply arise organically as academics within the imperial core, but they were also directly funded and supported by the capitalist ruling class through their foundations, primarily Rockefeller and Ford, but there were others involved as well as backed very heavily by the U.S. national security state, including organizations like the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. State Department. And so we see with their backers whose interests they ultimately serve, and bringing that political economy to the foreground is very important, because then even if you don't know anything about their theory or you haven't read any of their work, you know who supports them, and that should tell you everything you need to know when it comes to class struggle in theory. So the best way of understanding Western Marxism, in my opinion, is to clearly specify the driving force behind it, as well as its foundational ideological orientation. So Western Marxism arose and remains predominant within the imperial core. It is a type of Marxism that has been directly supported by the imperial ruling class, as I just mentioned, as a weapon of war against the anti-imperialist Marxism identified with the East and actually existing socialism more broadly. So concerning Western Marxism, while often Western Marxists will express some criticisms of capitalism, consumer society, neoliberalism, and these are people, if you're familiar with them, you know, it could be from the Frankfurt School, Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, it could be more contemporary figures, David Harvey, Slavoj Žižek, Horton Negri, Alain Badiou, the kind of titans of the imperial theory industry who self-proclaim as Marxists, but when you get into the details, they're theoretical Marxists rather than actual practical Marxists. And so they'll often be critical of capitalism, but they are overwhelmingly skeptical and generally hostile to actually existing socialism. So Western Marxism tends to reject Marxism in practice, which has historically served as the principal means of breaking the chains of imperialism. Western Marxists are thus, at a minimum, capitalist and often imperialist accommodationists, meaning that they ultimately accept it because they refuse to support the real fight against it, which is actually existing socialist state-building projects. So bringing these threads together, we can say that Western Marxism, at the end of the day, would better be described as imperial Marxism, insofar as it emerges in and is dominant within the imperial core, which is the driving socioeconomic force behind this ideological product, And secondly, it tends to accommodate and even support imperialism. So both at the level of the socioeconomic base and at the superstructural level of the ideology, it is imperial. Eastern Marxism, by contrast, and this is one of the reasons that it's interesting to organize this kind of, what would you call it, a counterposto? I don't know if someone's good here in music, but the montage between these two books is because Eastern Marxism has been widespread in the colonial and semi-colonial periphery, and it tends to reject imperialism while embracing the project of building socialism in the real world. We might then just simply call it anti-imperialist Marxism. This fundamental distinction ultimately allows us to bring into relief the two rival worldviews that can be found in imperial and anti-imperialist Marxism, which are essential for orienting ourselves in the world in general and in our organizing above and beyond theoretical class struggle between these two camps. Ultimately, Western or imperial Marxism is most important as a phenomenon, not in the academy, but insofar as it grips the masses in a broader world of organizing. In this regard, the two worldviews are on full display in the contemporary conjuncture insofar as much of the Western or imperial left has wildly mischaracterized contemporary imperialist wars, as well as the anti-imperialist movement. If it be among the intelligentsia or within the broader organizing world, there are many who muddle the waters, for instance, by claiming that countries like Russia, China, and Iran are imperialist or sub-imperialist. To make such a claim, you have to ignore centuries of material history and the concrete socioeconomic development of the planet, or underdevelopment over the overwhelming majority of the planet by the imperial forces. In this regard, the capitalist project of colonialism and neocolonialism has underdeveloped the tricontinent, Asia, Africa, and Latin America, in order to develop the imperial core, and more specifically, line the pockets of the imperial ruling class. Countries resisting imperial dominion have, either through bourgeois projects of national development or socialist projects of anti-colonial liberation, sought to remove themselves from the global chains of imperialist underdevelopment. In order to do so, they've had to develop their productive forces and work with other countries in a collaborative effort to push back against the imperial forces. On the flip side, you have the world's leading imperialist power, the United States, along with its junior partners, waging aggressive wars to try and break up the anti-imperialist camp and, in our conjuncture, the emergent multipolar world. This fundamental framing is absolutely essential for grasping the principal contradiction at work in our historical conjuncture. This framing recognizes that it is the socioeconomic base, namely imperial capitalism, that is the driving force in history, not the ideological superstructure. So, to bring this into relief, the difference between imperial and anti-imperialist Marxism, I'd like to just briefly elucidate, and this will be the end of my comments, how these two traditions relate to two regions that occupy extremely important positions in contemporary global class struggle, China and Palestine. To facilitate the comparison, I'll focus on Losordo and the work of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, which is widely recognized as being foundational to the tradition of Western Marxism. So people like Adorno and Horkheimer and Herbert Marcuse, but this tradition continues today with the likes of Nancy Fraser, Sheila Benhabib, and others. So Losordo, to begin with, always centered the colonial question and understood that socialism in the real world has taken the form of a fight on the part of the colonized peoples of the planet for self-determination. China and Palestine, with very different histories, have both been subjected to colonialism in various forms. In the case of China, it was able to break the chains of imperialism and begin a project of building socialism. One of the strengths of Losordo's analysis of China is that he mobilizes a dialectical understanding of socialism, meaning that he sees it as a process of socioeconomic transformation that emerges within an imperialist world. Moreover, socialism is what he calls, I mentioned this in my opening comments, a practical process of learning, since it is not the result of a blueprint or a perfect theory. It's not to be found, as Carlos was saying before, in a quotation from Marx or Engels. It is about a real-world project of building socialism in a hostile world. So having closely studied the case of the Soviet Union, China learned to chart its own unique path. And one of the things that Losordo points out in his support for the reform and opening up is the way in which China has always been pragmatically oriented to solving problems in the real world and recognized and continues to recognize that within an imperialist world, you have to deal with the extant play of forces. And if you simply enter into a combative relationship with them, as the Soviet Union had done in a slightly different form, then you are not necessarily destined to collapse or run into problems, but it will easily lead to a whole series of complications that were visible from the Chinese perspective within the Soviet Union. Now, the Western left intelligentsia has generally tended to see the reform and opening up as China's fulsome embrace of capitalism and even imperialism. What Lissordo provides us with, and this is another aspect of his dialectical approach to socialism, is looking at all of the different dimensions of the Chinese socialist state-building project, highlighting some of the things that Carlos just pointed out, where the towering heights of the economy are still in control of the state, where the state itself is in the hands of the Communist Party, where there is capitalist investment within the country. There are forms of development that are dependent on capitalist investment. But if you actually go through and analyze all of the different dimensions, you're given a much more complex understanding of contemporary China than the very simplistic, very binary apprehension that you get in the Western intelligentsia, where at best what you have is, well, it used to be Marxist and now it no longer is, right? So it's a very reified, or what Engels would call a metaphysical approach, where you simply think that a country is reducible to one concept. So it's either real socialism or it's absolute capitalism, and those are the only options. Instead of a dialectical apprehension that looks at the complexities of a historical situation in which there are very clearly, as Carlos pointed out, socialist elements operative within the project of contemporary China. By contrast, the Frankfurt School has tended, with very few exceptions, to ignore or downplay the colonial question while denigrating the efforts of the target countries of imperialism to develop socialism as a means of breaking the chains of imperialism. To cite but one example, Adorno and Horkheimer published one of their most overtly political texts in 1956, in which they celebrate, with only a few minor exceptions, the superiority of the West while denigrating and disparaging the Soviet Union and China, by invoking stock racist descriptions of the purported barbarians in the East, who they described as, quote, fascists, who had chosen, quote, slavery. At the same time, Adorno and Horkheimer, as well as the purportedly radical Herbert Marcuse, who worked for years for the State Department and was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation for the Marxism-Leninism Project, which is a direct attack on Eastern Marxism and actually existing socialism, Marcuse as well was a supporter, like Adorno and Horkheimer, of the imperialist settler colonial project in historic Palestine. This tradition of anti-communism and imperialist accommodation, or even imperialist support, has continued unabated today, with the most recent representatives of the Frankfurt School, Jürgen Habermas, Rainer Forst, and Sheila Ben-Habib, criticizing those who attribute, quote, genocidal intentions to Israel. This is what Habermas and Forst have said. And this was soon after the beginning of the most recent onslaught against the Palestinians, a time at which the genocidal intentions were clearly stated by Israeli leadership and the genocidal actions were being live-streamed to everyone around the world. Sheila Ben-Habib has claimed that, quote, the conflict in Israel-Palestine, right, conflict in Israel-Palestine, her language, analyzing it through the lens of settler colonialism alone is reductive, as if understanding this history in terms of settler colonialism was somehow leaving fundamental aspects out of the equation. Almost a year into Israel's war on Palestinians, and for that matter on Lebanon and the entire region, Ben-Habib defended her earlier article, insisting that Hamas is not a resistance movement, and that it, Hamas, not Israel, is, quote, holding the people of Gaza hostage, end quote. These are the leading Marxist luminaries of the imperial core. And what this brings clearly into relief is that the real relationship between imperial Marxism and anti-imperialist Marxism can be seen as a relationship between the rear guard of history, the people who are holding us back, just like the imperial core is holding humanity and the entire planet back, versus the anti-imperialist Marxists who are the vanguard of history, who are Marxists who are not only inventing new theories, newfangled concepts, new ways of thinking, but they're doing the most difficult task in the process of thinking because they're applying thought to practical problems and they're finding ways of solving those practical problems in a hostile world. So it's in this regard that bringing these two books together, one slightly more theoretical, one oriented a bit more towards practice, but ultimately both of them contributing to a very strong criticism of imperial Marxism in the name of uplifting anti-imperialist Marxism, I think is a very important contribution for the debate today, and I look forward to the rest of the conversation. So thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent.
Next, we're going to hear from Danny Haifong, who has a tremendous program every day, really, of interviewing, putting forth an anti-imperialist perspective in ways that are on the immediate issues of the day. And that could be NATO in the Ukraine, of course, often China and Danny's visits to China, but every part of the world, including the struggle right here. And we're in the center of imperialism. So the focus on it and the recognition that this is the enemy of the people of the whole world is a very important role. Danny is also a founding member of the Friends of Socialist China. So let me pass it on to Danny and to thank him also for his programs.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks to everyone who came today. Thank you to all the organizers. Thanks to Carlos and Gabriel for their great works and their great talks. I am going to focus on something a little different. I will be talking about China's foreign policy in particular and how it contrasts with U.S. foreign policy, not just because that's what I do a lot in my work, but also because in respect to what Gabriel and Carlos were saying, but also Carlos's book talking about People's China at 75, making this argument that the flag does stay red, that Chinese socialism is indeed not only not on the decline, but also on the rise and getting stronger. We can look at China's foreign policy as a huge example of this. And I just wanted to take a moment to talk about where we are right now. We have an incredibly intense three major fronts of war right now in West Asia and Ukraine, and the buildup in the Asia Pacific against China, led mainly by the United States and its European partners. Of course, war is truly global, and this leaves out Latin America, it leaves out the militarization of Africa, but on these major fronts, it is very much apparent that the imperial order, the United States' imperial order, is at the root. This unipolar order that much of the multipolar world, led by China and its major partner, Russia, call it. So it's not China right now displacing 1 million people in Lebanon or killing thousands of Lebanese people. It's not China that over the last year has seen the genocide of Palestinians, where upwards of 200,000 people have died by bunker bomb or by starvation or disease. And it certainly isn't China that sacrificed over 200,000, some say 500,000 Ukrainians at the altar of NATO's proxy war against Russia. If we trace the roots of all of this death and all of this destruction, we always find U.S. weapons, logistical support, coordination, and of course, outright participation. Now, the BRICS summit just ended in Kazan, and I think it's a towering example of this contrast I wanted to talk about between China and U.S. foreign policy. At the BRICS summit in Kazan, China made a huge splash, maybe the biggest splash, at the summit when Chinese President Xi Jinping met with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in the first diplomatic meeting between the two countries in 5 years to finalize, along with other matters, a huge border deal, which essentially de-escalates along this 1,500-kilometer border, which is the source of much tension that has been provoked, in my estimation, by the West. So this has sent shockwaves down the spines of the warmongers in Washington and the corporate media. And in his address to the BRICS summit, Xi Jinping said that this mechanism, this multilateral mechanism, is indeed a major stepping stone of global solidarity for the global South. And we see this quite clearly in how China is behaving with a country that's supposed to be one of the most contentious, dare I say, enemies. There's really bad blood in many respects between India and China. We have just witnessed one of the biggest steps toward remedying those disputes in recent history. Belarus, the leader of Belarus, Viktor Lukashenko, said that without China, there would really be no BRICS. So we have to ask ourselves, why? Why does China behave this way? Why is China pursuing multilateralism? Why is it pursuing multipolarity? Why is it pursuing friendship with everybody, any country, any nation that wants friendship, that wants peace, that wants cooperation, that wants development? Why does it do this? Because we hear all the time in the Western mainstream media, China's the aggressor. China's bullying its own province, Taiwan. China's expanding its reach at the expense of its neighbors, and China is debt trapping African countries and countries in the global south. Of course, all of this is merely imperial doublespeak and projection that simply negates and masks China's true role as a diplomatic and economic force for peace in the world, which I believe at its core has to do with China's social system. And if you go to China, that is what many people will tell you, that it's their social system. It is their social system of socialism with Chinese characteristics that informs this. Just take the Belt and Road Initiative. I'll just throw out some examples. This is a 150-plus country integration project. You have 30 organizations internationally also signed on. You have over $1 trillion U.S. dollars. So if you times that by about 8, you get 8 trillion Chinese yuan invested in this project, where accomplishments just in the last decade, 15 years alone, have included the first metro system in Lahore, Pakistan, the monumental high-speed rail project that was opened up in Laos just a few years ago, which connects Laos to not just Kunming, China, but also its neighbors like Thailand. We could go on and on and on about all of the different projects, the electricity, the 5G technology that it's brought to African countries like Nigeria, and of course the forgiveness of loans, which we don't really hear about. We hear about these mysterious airports like in Uganda, this mysterious port in Sri Lanka that supposedly went awry, but you never hear about the 19, 20 African countries that China forgave loans for during COVID-19 when the world economy was essentially plunged into disaster, not by China. China kept growing during COVID-19. China was one of the few countries that did during that economic crisis, but it was plunged into just absolute hell because of the Western world, because of the United States-led Western world. So let's also take the example of diplomacy, because a lot of attention is placed on how China behaves economically around the world, how negative it is, when indeed a lot of its contributions are positive. But just diplomatically, in the last couple of years alone, we've had all of the Palestinian resistance groups go to Beijing and sign the Beijing Declaration, which essentially is a roadmap toward not only resolving differences between these groups, but establishing a legitimate Palestinian state that takes into account all of the different forces that are vying for leadership and attempting to cooperate through the Israeli genocidal onslaught sponsored by the United States. Then you also had the normalization deal that was brokered in Beijing in 2023 between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which is already paying dividends. We see that in this creep toward an all-out war with Iran, where Saudi Arabia is even more vocal than before in rejecting the United States using its airspace, rejecting Israel using its airspace in order to conduct any kind of retaliation and strike against Iran. Funny word, retaliation, when actually it's Iran being attacked by the United States and by Israel. And of course, we can talk on and on and on about how China has been a force for integration in Asia as the foremost leader of the ASEAN group and this magnificent free trade deal that these countries have sponsored that is always tarnished and ignored by all of this Taiwan question. Will there be an invasion of Taiwan? Will there be a war over Taiwan? When is there going to be a war with the Philippines? There's always some reason for the United States and the West to talk about China in this way. But the reality is that China is trading. It is cooperating with all countries. Doesn't matter their political system. It is taking a very diplomatic approach and a very economic approach that benefits everybody in that region and the rest of the world. And we have to ask ourselves, then why is there so much apprehension toward China? Well, in my estimation, it's not just because it plays this huge role with the multipolar world, with this world that includes many social systems working together in order to bring development and peace It is also because China still subscribes and will, in my opinion, continue to subscribe to socialism with Chinese characteristics. It is for this reason that China will never have respite from the United States or its Western partners. And that is why every single imperial project, every war, we can look at and say all roads are leading to Beijing. Some may disagree with you. Some think Russia is the primary enemy of the United States right now. But if you look at how the U.S. empire talks about these two countries, it is always in conjunction with each other. And you can see the calculations being made about, well, what is the order of toppling these countries? It always goes, usually, Iran, Russia, you can kind of now at this point in history, because Israel is on this genocidal and absolutely suicidal onslaught, now they can be almost seen together. But generally, the order is, let's go from smaller to bigger. Let's topple the Libyas, let's topple the Syrias, let's get to Iran, let's go to Moscow, and then let's end it in Beijing. That's why they call the United States and its elites and those who are building up these wars, they call it containment. Because at this moment, they do not believe that they can win any kind of military conflict. They already gambled and lost one in Ukraine, and they know in their heart of hearts that such a thing would be even worse with China. Now, I think what's so striking about China in particular is how much animus there is toward China, not just from people who you would expect. You'd expect people who are rabidly anti-communist, who have been injected with yellow peril, fear, and hatred for decades, if not centuries, who grew up in the Cold War and who believe that all forms of socialism and communism must be eradicated. You expect those people to hate China, to want to see China overthrown. But at this moment, and that's why I think books like People's China at 75, as well as Western Marxism, are so important, because at this moment, actually, one of the biggest problems we have is that much of the so-called left actually hates China, and that their hatred of China, their animus toward China, is one of the most counterproductive developments and realities that we face as a people, as a movement, and as a project for peace. And we have to ask ourselves, well, why is this? Well, People's China at 75, Western Marxism, these books will tell you why this is. They'll tell you about how there are deep forces in the academic and even in the activist communities that work to undermine our ability to have solidarity, to connect and lock all of these conflicts, these wars, toward a single common cause. But it's actually quite easy. The U.S. empire, these imperialists, these rulers, the ruling class, they tell you what the reasons are. They'll tell you in the Western mainstream media what they are. They won't be framed in the words that we would want them to be framed in, because they frame them in terms of propaganda war. They talk about how much they fear China's economic rise. They talk about how, but at what cost is China's poverty alleviation or its infrastructure development or the rising standard of living in China? They'll talk about all this. They'll talk about human rights. They'll project all of this human rights animus and propaganda and misinformation. They'll do all of this. And at the same time, what they'll say at the end is, well, China is a competitor. China is a rival. They won't tell you why, though. The biggest reason why is that China is charting a mode and system of development right now in the world, which actually is a threat. It's not the threat that we hear, China threat. Oh no, China's stealing our technology, which just means China's doing it better than us. It's not, oh, China is genociding the Uyghurs or something ridiculous like that. It's a threat because China is raising the standard of living of its own people. China is also raising the standard of living, the World Bank will tell you, of people all around the world. The Belt and Road Initiative, its development projects, all of this has brought hundreds of thousands, if not millions of jobs all across the world, rising the standard of living for nations which have had no alternative since the fall of the Soviet Union. That's the reality. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States, essentially what it did was it said, we will give you one option, and that's the military option. We will allow you to exist so long as you allow us to be the foremost military power. Your economies be damned. We do not care. Take those IMF loans. you can be left to die. This is why U.S. investment in Africa is barely over 40 billion U.S. dollars. There's 50 plus countries in Africa. It's one of the most richest continents in the world, if not the richest. And yet, only 45 billion U.S. dollars invested in any kind of economic development in Africa. I think that tells the story. China, over 200. It's creeping toward 300 billion because China sees the worth of helping people who have been super exploited for decades, centuries. They see the worth in rising their standard of living. And you go to China and they'll tell you, it's not necessarily all about solidarity or charity. It's not charity. It's not, oh, well, we want to give back, right? It's none of that. Actually, what it is China is rapidly growing. China and Chinese people see a lot of their, as Gabriel said, with regard to Palestine, with Africa, a lot of Chinese see Africans as having a shared history. This dates all the way back to the beginnings of the Chinese Revolution with projects like the Tanzan Railway. But now they see also there is so much potential for African people to become, because they're so wealthy, they're sitting on this bed of wealth, of natural resources. If they build up their industries, they raise their wages, they can become consumers of Chinese goods. And that will help China relieve pressure on their own massive manufacturing economy and also allow African people to live better, to have 5G technology, to have trains, to have electric vehicles, to have these things that have been denied to them for so long, despite literally sitting on all the natural resources that are required to produce them. But we cannot even have this discussion because much of the so-called left wants to talk about how China is authoritarian or China is a dictatorship or China's socialist and that's bad. All of this nonsense, what Carlos called the neither Washington nor Beijingers, those who believe that China is a competitor of the United States and no different from the U.S., that it'll just adopt. There's even an argument, you might know him, John Mearsheimer, a realist. He'll say, well, once China's in the position of the United States, then it will be like the United States. Once it has the ability to traverse its own waters in the Pacific without any threat to its own position, then it will be like the U.S. and begin to terrorize countries around the world and look after only its own interests. That's what I guess realists believe. But I think in the real world, if we go into the real world, we can ask ourselves, well, why would anyone think this? What material basis, what reality are they looking at? And I think the answer to this is they're not. They're looking at this land of ideals that we live in the United States, this fantasy of American exceptionalism, that there can really be no alternative to how the United States and its imperial order does things. That if that isn't what is, then nothing else really can be. If I'm too, I feel like I sound like Kamala Harris there. but I think I made a little more sense than her. So we can just look at China's foreign policy. We can look at what China is doing. China is calling for diplomacy in Ukraine, a real resolution, peace. That's what it's calling for. China is looking to become not just a diplomatic force for peace in West Asia, but also it's offering, and it will. It has done this, it has committed to this in Syria, in Iraq, to rebuild those countries, to rebuild Palestine, once there is the conditions present for that to happen. But of course, we can see that China is not the bully. China is not waging war. China is not spending enormous sums of money to commit war crimes for the sake of profit and dominance that is required to keep this system, this bloody system, greedy system of empire, of imperialism, of capitalism going. So we have a choice. I mean, we have a choice right now. And that's why I don't do geopolitical analysis and say, oh, well, let's just look at the facts. I think we have a choice. We need to be part of this process. We need to talk about China. That's why books like this are so important, like People's China at 75. We need to talk about this process at its root. We need to build real understanding. Every time I go to China, that is what I am trying to do, build real understanding of what people there are doing, what that government, what that system is doing. Not what the Western media says it's doing, not constantly having to show people, and I don't even like doing this, but last time I was in Xinjiang, it's like, hey, look, Uyghurs exist. They do things. They play basketball. You know, they're professors. They're normal people. And guess what? Those normal people also talk about their country and their existence far different than what we hear in Bloomberg or The Economist or what have you. So we need to get out of that position. But the only way we can is by looking at these problems at the root, looking at empire at the root, and not simply just following developments, waiting for the United States, waiting for this empire to make what really will be the last war that it fights. Because in the words of Victor Gao, who I spoke to earlier today, former interpreter of Deng Xiaoping, he said, it'll be Armageddon, and that will be it. That it will be over. There will be nothing left for anybody. But this is why China says no war. They don't want war. They're not trying to fight a war with the United States. If they wanted a war with the United States, they could easily, they're showing, they could easily just resolve the Taiwan question militarily and say, this is it. No more money to Taiwan separatists, weapons to Taiwan separatists, no more of this provocation. We will not only encircle and blockade this island, but we will reunify by force. And yet they don't do it. And why doesn't China do it? Because they want a peaceful resolution, they want peaceful reunification, and they want, that is the model for all of China's foreign policy. And that exists because China's system is at the root in the forefront of its foreign policy. And that's why it's able to succeed at the home front. That's why it's able to raise standard of living, to eliminate extreme poverty, to become the leader in high tech, to become the leader in renewable energy, and to do things that we didn't know humans could do before this, to be able to go from one of the poorest countries in the world to now the most prosperous, as well as soon to be one of the most shining examples of what it means to distribute that wealth and distribute that prosperity in a way that serves everybody and not just the few.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode celebrated the release of two books. One is entitled People's China at 75, The Flag Stays Red, edited by Keith Bennett and panelist Carlos Martinez. The other book is the English translation of Western Marxism, How It Was Born, How It Died, How It Can Be Reborn, authored by Domenico Losurdo and edited by panelist Gabriel Rockhill. The third panelist was Danny Haifong, and the moderator was Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center. The talk took place at the office of the International Action Center in New York City on October 24, 2024, and was organized by Friends of Socialist China and Workers' World Party. Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.